tone as he fell. She spun and found another wolf behind her, and slashed him across the brow beneath his helm. His own cut caught her below the breast, but her mail turned it. So she drove the point of her dirk into his throat, and left him to drown in his own blood. A hand seized her hair, but short as it was, he could not get a good enough grip to wrench her head back. Asher slammed her boot heel down into his instep, and wrenched loose when he cried out in pain. By the time she turned, the man was down and dying, still clutching a handful of her hair. Carl stood over him, with his longsword dripping and moonlight shining in his eyes. Grimtongue was counting the Northmen as he killed them, calling out, "Four!" as one went down, "Five!" a heartbeat later. The horses screamed and kicked and rolled their eyes in terror, maddened by the butchery and blood. All but Triss Butler's big roan stallion. Triss had gained the saddle, and his mount was rearing and wheeling as he laid about with his sword. "I may owe him a kiss or three before the night is done," thought Asher. "Seven!" shouted Grimtongue, but beside him Lauren Longaxe sprawled with one leg twisted under him, and the shadows kept on coming, shouting and rustling. "We are fighting shrubbery," Asher thought, as she slew a man who had more leaves on him than most of the surrounding trees. That made her laugh. Her laughter drew more wolves to her, and she killed them too, wondering if she should start a count of her own. "I am a woman wed, and here's my suckling babe." She pushed her dirk into a Northman's chest, through fur and wool and boiled leather. His face was so close to hers that she could smell the sour stench of his breath, and his hand was at her throat. Asher felt iron scraping against bone as her point slid over a rib. Then the man shuddered and died. When she let go of him, she was so weak she almost fell on top of him. Later, she stood back to back with Carl, listening to the grunts and curses all around them, to brave men crawling through the shadows, weeping for their mothers. A bush drove at her with a spear long enough to punch through her belly and Carl's back as well, pinning them together as they died. "Better that than die alone," she thought. But her cousin Quentin killed the spearman before he reached her. A heartbeat later, another bush killed Quentin, driving an axe into the base of his skull. Behind her, Grimtongue shouted, "Nine, and damn you all!" Hagen's daughter burst naked from beneath the trees with two wolves at her heels. Asher wrenched loose a throwing axe and sent it flying end over end to take one of them in the back. When he fell, Hagen's daughter stumbled to her knees, snatched up his sword, stabbed the second man, then rose again, smeared with blood and mud, her long red hair unbound, and plunged into the fight. Somewhere in the ebb and flow of battle, Asher lost Carl, lost Triss, lost all of them. Her dirk was gone as well, and all her throwing axes. Instead, she had a sword in hand, a short sword with a broad, thick blade, almost like a butcher's cleaver. For her life, she could not have said where she had gotten it. Her arm ached, her mouth tasted of blood, her legs were trembling, and shafts of pale dawn light were slanting through the trees. "Has it been so long? How long have we been fighting?" Her last foe was a Northman with an axe, a big man, bald and bearded, clad in a burnie of patched and rusted mail that could only mean he was a chief or champion. He was not pleased to find himself fighting a woman. "Cunt!" he roared each time he struck at her, his spittle dampening her cheeks. "Cunt! Cunt!" Asher wanted to shout back at him, but her throat was so dry she could do no more than grunt. His axe was shivering her shield, cracking the wood on the downswing, tearing off long, pale splinters when he wrenched it back. Soon she would have only a tangle of kindling on her arm. She backed away and shook free of the ruined shield, then backed away some more and danced left and right and left again to avoid the down-rushing axe. And then her back came up hard against a tree, and she could dance no more. The wolf raised the axe above his head to split her head in two. Asher tried to slip to her right, but her feet were tangled in some roots, trapping her. She twisted, lost her footing, and the axe head crunched against her temple with a scream of steel on steel. The world went red and black and red again. Pain crackled up her leg like lightning, and far away she heard her Northman say, "You bloody cunt!" as he lifted up his axe for the blow that would finish her. A trumpet blew. "That's wrong," she thought. "There are no trumpets in the drowned guard's watery halls. Below the waves, the Merlings hail their lord by blowing into seashells." She dreamed of red hearts burning, and a black stag in a golden wood with flame streaming from his antlers.
Daenerys. "All?" The slave girl sounded weary.
"Your Grace, did this one's worthless ears mishear you?"
Cool green light filtered down through the diamond-shaped panes of coloured glass set in the sloping triangular walls, and a breeze was blowing gently through the terrace doors, carrying the scents of fruit and flowers from the garden beyond. "Your ears heard true," said Danny. "I want to buy them all. Tell the good masters, if you will." She had chosen a Carthene gown today. The deep violet silk brought out the purple of her eyes. The cut of it bared her left breast. While the good masters of Astapor conferred among themselves in low voices, Danny sipped tart persimmon wine from a tall silver flute. She could not quite make out all they were saying, but she could hear the greed. Each of the eight brokers was attended by two or three body slaves, though one, Grasdan, the eldest, had six. So as not to seem a beggar, Danny had brought her own attendants, Iri and Jiqui, in their sand-silk trousers and painted vests, old Whitebeard and mighty Belwas, her blood riders. Sir Jorah stood behind her, sweltering in his green surcoat with a black bear of Mormont embroidered upon it. The smell of his sweat was an earthy answer to the sweet perfumes that drenched the Astapori.
"All,"
growled Krasny's Monaklos, who smelled of peaches today. The slave girl repeated the word in the common tongue of Westeros.
"Of thousands there are eight. Is this what she means by all? There are also six centuries, who shall be part of a 9,000 when complete. Would she have them too?"
"I would," said Danny when the question was put to her. "The 8,000s, the 6 centuries, and the ones still in training as well, the ones who have not earned the spikes." Krasny's turned back to his fellows. Once again they conferred amongst themselves. The translator had told Danny their names, but it was hard to keep them straight. 4 of the men seemed to be named Grasdan, presumably after Grasdan the Great, who had founded Old Gis in the dawn of days. They all looked alike, thick, fleshy men with amber skin, broad noses, dark eyes. Their wiry hair was black, or dark red, or a queer mixture of red and black that was peculiar to Giscari. All wrapped themselves in tokars, a garment permitted only to freeborn men of Astapor. It was the fringe of the tokar that proclaimed a man's status, Danny had been told by Captain Grolio. In this cool green room atop the pyramid, 2 of the slavers wore tokars fringed in silver, 5 had gold fringes, and 1, the oldest Grasdan, displayed a fringe of fat white pearls that clacked together softly when he shifted in his seat or moved an arm.
"We cannot sell half-trained boys,"
one of the silver-fringed Grasdans was saying to the others.
"We can, if her gold is good, eh?"
said a fatter man whose fringe was gold.
"They are not unsullied. They have not killed their sucklings. If they fail in the field, they will shame us. And even if we cut 5,000 war boys tomorrow, it would be 10 years before they are fit for sale. What would we tell the next buyer who comes seeking unsullied?"
"'We will tell him that he must wait, eh?'
said the fat man.
"'Gold in my purse is better than gold in my future.'
Danny let them argue, sipping the tart persimmon wine and trying to keep her face blank and ignorant. "'I will have them all, no matter the price,' she told herself. The city had 100 slave traders, but the 8 before her were the greatest. When selling bed slaves, field hands, scribes, craftsmen, and tutors, these men were rivals. But their ancestors had allied one with the other for the purpose of making and selling the unsullied. Brick and blood built Astapor, and brick and blood her people. It was Krasnys who finally announced their decision.
Tell her that the 8,000 she shall have, if her gold prove sufficient. And the 6 centuries, if she wishes. Tell her to come back in a year, and we will sell her another 2,000.
In a year I shall be in Westeros, said Danny, when she heard the translation. My need is now. The Unsullied are well trained, but even so many will fall in battle. I shall need the boys as replacements to take up the swords they drop. She put her wine aside and leaned toward the slave girl. Tell the good masters that I will want even the little ones who still have their puppies. Tell them that I will pay as much for the boy they cut yesterday as for an unsullied in a spiked helm. The girl told him. The answer was still no. Danny frowned in annoyance. Very well. Tell them I will pay double, so long as I get them all.
Double, eh?
The fat one in the gold fringe orb drooled.
This little whore is a fool, truly, said Krasnys Monaklos. Ask her for triple, I say. She is desperate enough to pay. Ask for 10 times the price of every slave, yes.
The tall Agrasdan, with a spiked beard, spoke in the common tongue, though not so well as a slave girl.
Your Grace, he growled, Westeros is being wealthy, yes, but you are not being queen now. Perhaps will never be queen. Even Unsullied may be losing battles to savage steel knights of 7 kingdoms. I am reminding the good masters of Astapor are not selling flesh for promises. Are you having gold and trading goods sufficient to be paying for all these eunuchs you are wanting?
You know the answer to that better than I, good master, Danny replied. Your men have gone through my ships and tallied every bead of amber and jar of saffron. How much do I have?
Sufficient to be buying 1,000, the good master said with a contemptuous smile. Yet you are paying double, you are seeing. 5 centuries, then, is all you buy.
Your pretty crown might buy another century, said the fat one in Valyrian. Your crown of the 3 dragons.
Danny waited for his words to be translated. My crown is not for sale. When Viserys sold their mother's crown, the last joy had gone from him, leaving only rage. Nor will I enslave my people, nor sell their goods and horses. But my ships you can have. The great cog, Balerion, and the galleys, Vhagar and Meraxes. She had warned Grolio and the other captains it might come to this, though they had protested the necessity of it furiously. 3 good ships should be worth more than a few paltry eunuchs. The fat Grasden turned to the others. They conferred in low voices once again. 2,000, the one with the spiked beard said when he turned back.
It is too much, but the good masters are being generous, and your need is being great.
2,000 would never serve for what she meant to do. I must have them all. Danny knew what she must do now, though the taste of it was so bitter that even the persimmon wine could not cleanse it from her mouth. She had considered long and hard and found no other way. It is my only choice. Give me all, she said, and you may have a dragon. There was a sound of indrawn breath from Jiqui beside her. Krasnys smiled at his fellows.
Did I not tell you, eh? Anything she would give us.
Whitebeard stared in shocked disbelief. His hand trembled where it grasped the staff.
No,
He went to one knee before her.
Your Grace, I beg you, win your throne with dragons, not slaves. You must not do this thing.
You must not presume to instruct me. Sir Jorah, remove Whitebeard from my presence. Mormont seized the old man roughly by an elbow, yanked him back to his feet, and marched him out onto the terrace. "Tell the good masters I regret this interruption," said Danny to the slave girl. "Tell them I await their answer." She knew the answer, though. She could see it in the glitter of their eyes and the smiles they tried so hard to hide. Astapor had thousands of eunuchs and even more slave boys waiting to be cut, but there were only 3 living dragons in all the great wide world. And the Giskari lust for dragons. How could they not? 5 times had old Gis contended with Valyria when the world was young, and 5 times gone down to bleak defeat. For the Freehold had dragons, and the Empire had none. The oldest Grasdan stirred in his seat, and his pearls clacked together softly.
"A dragon of our choice," he said in a thin, hard voice. "The black one is largest and healthiest."
"His name is Drogon," she nodded.
"All your goods, save your crown and your queenly raiment, which we will allow you to keep. The 3 ships and Drogon."
"Done," she said, in the common tongue.
"Done,"
the old Grasdan answered in his thick Valyrian. The others echoed that old man of the pearl fringe.
"Done," the slave girl translated. And done, 8 times done."
"The Unsullied will learn your savage tongue quick enough," added Krasny's Monaclus, when all the arrangements had been made. "But until such time, you will need a slave to speak to them. Take this one as our gift to you, a token of our bargain well struck."
"I shall," said Danny. The slave girl rendered his words to her and hers to him. If she had feelings about being given for a token, she took care not to let them show. Aston Whitebeard held his tongue as well when Danny swept by him on the terrace. He followed her down the steps in silence, but she could hear his hardwood staff tap-tapping on the red bricks as they went. She did not blame him for his fury. It was a wretched thing she did. The mother of dragons has sold her strongest child. Even the thought made her ill. Yet down in the Plaza of Pride, standing on the hot red bricks between the slaver's pyramid and the barracks of the eunuchs, Danny turned on the old man. "Whitebeard," she said, "I want your counsel, and you should never fear to speak your mind with me when we are alone, but never question me in front of strangers. Is that understood?"
"Yes, Your Grace," he said unhappily.
"I am not a child," she told him. "I am a queen."
"Yet even queens can err. The Astapori have cheated you, Your Grace. A dragon is worth more than any army. Aegon proved that 300 years ago upon the Field of Fire."
"I know what Aegon proved. I mean to prove a few things of my own." Danny turned away from him to the slave girl standing meekly beside her litter. "Do you have a name, or must you draw a new one every day from some barrel?"
"That is only her Unsullied," the girl said,
and she realized the question had been asked in High Valyrian. Her eyes went wide.
"Oh,
your name is O?"
"No, Your Grace, forgive this one her outburst. Your slave's name is Masandi, but—"
"Masandi is no longer a slave. I free you from this instant. Come ride with me in the litter. I wish to talk." Recaro helped them in, and Danny drew the curtains shut against the dust and heat. "If you stay with me, you will serve as one of my handmaids," she said as they set off. "I shall keep you by my side to speak for me as you spoke for Krasnys. But you may leave my service whenever you choose. If you have a father or a mother you would sooner return to—"
"This one will stay," the girl said. "This one, there is no place for me to go. This I will serve you gladly."
"I can give you freedom, but not safety," Danny warned. "I have a world to cross and wars to fight. You may go hungry. You may grow sick. You may be killed."
"Vela Morghulis," said Missandei in High Valyrian.
All men must die, Danny agreed, but not for a long while, we may pray. She leaned back on the pillows and took the girl's hand. Are these unsullied, truly fearless?
Yes, Your Grace.
You serve me now. Is it true they feel no pain?
The wine of courage kills such feelings. By the time they slay their sucklings, they have been linking it for years.
And they are obedient?
Obedience is all they know. If you told them not to breathe, they would find that easier than not to obey.
Danny nodded. And when I am done with them?
Your Grace?
When I have won my war and claimed the throne that was my father's, my knights will sheathe their swords and return to their keeps, to their wives and children and mothers, to their lives. But these eunuchs have no lives. What am I to do with 8,000 eunuchs when there are no more battles to be fought?
They are solid, make fine guards, and excellent watchmen, Your Grace,
said Melisandre.
And it is never hard to find a buyer for such fine, well-blooded troops.
Men are not bought and sold in Westeros, they tell me.
With all respect, Your Grace, unsullied are not men.
If I did resell them, how would I know they could not be used against me? Danny asked pointedly. Would they do that? Fight against me? Even do me harm?
If their master commanded, they do not question, Your Grace. All the questions have been culled from them. They obey.
She looked troubled.
When you are done with them, Your Grace might command them to fall upon their swords.
And even that they would do?
Yes.
Missandei's voice had grown soft.
Your Grace.
Danny squeezed her hand. You would sooner I did not ask it of them, though. Why is that? Why do you care?
Oh, this one does not... Your Grace...
Tell me. The girl lowered her eyes.
Three of them were my brothers once, Your Grace.
Then I hope your brothers are as brave and clever as you. Danny leaned back into her pillow and let the litter bear her onward back to Valerian one last time to set her world in order. And back to Drogon. Her mouth set grimly. It was a long, dark, windy night that followed. Danny fed her dragons, as she always did, but found she had no appetite herself. She cried a while, alone in her cabin, then dried her tears long enough for yet another argument with Grolio. Magister Illyrio is not here, she finally had to tell him, and if he was, he could not sway me either. I need the Unsullied more than I need these ships, and I will hear no more about it. The anger burned the grief and fear from her for a few hours at the least. Afterwards she called her blood riders to her cabin with Ser Jorah. They were the only ones she truly trusted. She meant to sleep afterward, to be well rested for the morrow, but an hour of restless tossing in the stuffy confines of the cabin soon convinced her that that was hopeless. Outside her door she found Aegor fitting a new string to his bow by the light of a swinging oil lamp. Rakaro sat cross-legged on the deck beside him, sharpening his arrack with a whetstone. Danny told them both to keep on with what they were doing, and went up on deck for a taste of the cool night air. The crew left her alone as they went about their business, but Ser Jorah soon joined her by the rail. He is never far, Danny thought. He knows my moods too well.
Khaleesi, you ought to be asleep. Tomorrow will be hot and hard, I promise you. You'll need your strength.
Do you remember Aroa? She asked him.
The Lazarine girl?
They were raping her, but I stopped them and took her under my protection. Only when my son and Stars was dead, Mago took her back, used her again, and killed her. Aegor said it was her fate.
I remember, Ser Jorah said.
I was alone for a long time, Jorah. All alone, but for my brother. I was such a small, scared thing. Viserys should have protected me, but instead he hurt me and scared me worse. He shouldn't have done that. He wasn't just my brother, he was my king. Why do the guards make kings and queens if not to protect the ones who can't protect themselves?
Some kings make themselves. Robert did.
He was no true king, Danny said scornfully. He did no justice. Justice. That's what kings are for. Sir Jorah had no answer. He only smiled and touched her hair. So lightly. It was enough. That night, she dreamt that she was Rhaegar, riding to the Trident. But she was mounted on a dragon, not a horse. When she saw the usurper's rebel host across the river, they were armored all in ice, but she bathed them in dragonfire and they melted away like dew and turned the Trident into a torrent. Some small part of her knew that she was dreaming, but another part exulted. This is how it was meant to be. The other was a nightmare, and I've only now awakened. She woke suddenly in the darkness of her cabin, still flush with triumph. Valyrian seemed to wake with her, and she heard the faint creak of wood, water lapping against the hull, a footfall on the deck above her head, and something else. Someone was in the cabin with her. Eri? Shiqui? Where are you? Her handmaids did not respond. It was too black to see, but she could hear them breathing. Shara, is that you?
Nice sleep,
a woman said.
May you sleep.
The voice was very close.
Even dragons must sleep.
She is standing over me. Who's there? Danny peered into the darkness. She thought she could see a shadow, the faintest outline of a shape. What do you want of me?
Remember, to go north, you must journey south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow.
Quaithe? Danny sprung from her bed and threw open the door. Pale yellow lantern light flooded the cabin, and Eri and Jiqui sat up sleepily.
Khaleesi?
Murmured Jiqui, rubbing her eyes. Viserion woke and opened his jaws, and a puff of flame brightened even the darkest corners. There was no sign of a woman in a red lacquer mask.
Khaleesi, are you unwell?
Asked Jiqui. A dream. Danny shook her head. I dreamed a dream. No more. Go back to sleep. All of us. Go back to sleep. Yet try as she might, sleep would not come again. If I look back, I am lost, Danny told herself the next morning as she entered Astapor through the harbour gates. She dared not remind herself how small and insignificant her following truly was, or she would lose all courage. Today she rode her silver, clad in horsehair pants and painted leather vest, a bronze medallion belt about her waist and two more crossed between her breasts. Eri and Jiqui had braided her hair and hung it with a tiny silver bell, whose chime sang of the undying of Carth, burned in their palace of dust. The red brick streets of Astapor were almost crowded this morning. Slaves and servants lined the ways, while the slavers and their women donned their tokars to look down from their stepped pyramids. They are not so different from Carthene, after all, she thought. They want a glimpse of dragons to tell their children of, and their children's children. It made her wonder how many of them would ever have children. Aego went before her with his great Dothraki bow. Strong Belwas walked to the right of her mare, the girl Missandei to her left. Sir Jorah Mormont was behind, in mail and surcoat, glowering at anyone who came too near. Ricaro and Jogo protected the litter. Danny had commanded that the top be removed so her three dragons might be chained to the platform. Eri and Jiqui rode with them to try and keep them calm. Yet Viserion's tail lashed back and forth, and smoke rose angry from his nostrils. Rhaegal could sense something wrong as well. Thrice he tried to take wing, only to be pulled down by the heavy chain in Jiqui's hand. Drogon coiled into a ball, wings and tail tucked tight. Only his eyes remained to tell that he was not asleep. The rest of her people followed, Grolio and the other captains and their crews, and the 83 Dothraki who remained to her of the 100,000 who had once ridden in Drogo's Khalasar. She put the oldest and weakest on the inside of the column, with the nursing women and those with child, and the little girls and the boys too young to braid their hair. The rest, her warriors, such as they were, rode outside and moved their dismal herd along, the 100-odd gaunt horses that had survived both Red Waste and Black Salt Sea. "I ought to have a banner sewn," she thought, as she led her tattered band up along Astapor's meandering river. She closed her eyes to imagine how it would look, all flowing black silk, and on it the red three-headed dragon of Targaryen, breathing golden flames. A banner such as Rhaegar might have borne. The river's banks were strangely tranquil. The Worm, the Astapori call the stream. It was wide and slow and crooked, dotted with tiny wooded islands. She glimpsed children playing on one of them, darting amongst elegant marble statues. On another island, two lovers kissed in the shade of tall green trees with no more shame than Dothraki at a wedding. Without clothing, she could not tell if they were slave or free. The Plaza of Pride, with its great bronze harpy, was too small to hold all the Unsullied she had bought. Instead, they had been assembled in the Plaza of Punishment, fronting on Astapor's main gate, so they might be marched directly from the city once Daenerys had taken them in hand. There were no bronze statues here, only a wooden platform where rebellious slaves were racked and flayed and hanged.
"The good masters place them so they will be the first thing a new slave sees upon entering the city,"
Missandei told her as they came to the plaza. At first glimpse, Dany thought their skin was striped, like the zorsis of Jogos Nahi. Then she rode her silver nearer and saw the raw red flesh beneath the crawling black stripes. Flies. Flies and maggots. The rebellious slaves had been peeled like a man might peel an apple in a long, curling strip. One man had an arm black with flies from fingers to elbow, and red and white beneath. Dany reined in beneath him. What did this one do?
"He raised a hand against his honor."
Her stomach roiling, Dany wheeled her silver about and trotted toward the center of the plaza and the army she had bought so dear. Rank on rank on rank they stood, her stone halfmen with their hearts of brick, 8,600 in the spiked bronze caps of fully trained Unsullied, and 5,000-odd behind them, bareheaded, yet armed with spears and short swords. The ones farthest to the back were only boys, she saw, but they stood as straight and still as all the rest. Krasnys Mor Nachlas and his fellows were all there to greet her. Other well-born Astapori stood in knots behind them, sipping wine from silver flutes, as slaves circulated among them with trays of olives and cherries and figs. The elder Grasdan sat in a sedan chair supported by four huge copper-skinned slaves. Half a dozen mounted lancers rode along the edges of the plaza, keeping back the crowds who had come to watch. The sun flashed blinding bright off the polished copper discs sewn to their cloaks, but she could not help but notice how nervous their horses seemed. They fear the dragons, and well they might. Krasnys had a slave help her from her saddle. His own hands were full. One clutched his tokar, while the other held an ornate whip.
"Here they are," he looked at Missandei. "Tell her they are hers, if she can pay."
"She can,"
the girl said. So Jorah barked a command, and the trade goods were brought forward. 6 bales of tiger skins, 300 bolts of fine silk, jars of saffron, jars of myrrh, jars of pepper and curry and cardamom, an onyx mask, 12 jade monkeys, casks of ink in red and black and green, a box of rare black amethysts, a box of pearls, a cask of pitted olives stuffed with maggots, a dozen casks of pickled cavefish, a great brass gong, and a hammer to beat it with, 17 ivory eyes, and a huge chest full of books written in tongues that Danny could not read, and more, and more, and more. Her people stacked it all before the slavers. While the payment was being made, Krasny's Monaclus favoured her with a few final words on the handling of her troops.
"They are green as yet," he said through Missandei. "Tell the whore of Westeros she would be wise to blood them early. There are many small cities between here and there, cities ripe for sacking. Whatever plunder she takes will be hers alone. Unsullied have no lust for gold or gems, and should she take captives, a few guards will suffice to march them back to Astapor. We'll buy the healthy ones for a good price, and who knows, in 10 years some of the boys she sends us may be unsullied in their turn. Thus all shall prosper."
Finally, there were no more trade goods to add to the pile. Her Dothraki mounted their horses once more, and Danny said, "This was all we could carry. The rest awaits you on the ships, a great quantity of amber and wine and black rice. And you have the ships themselves, so all that remains is the dragon," finished the Grasdan with a spiked beard who spoke the common tongue so thickly. "And here he waits." Sir Jorah and Belwas walked beside her to the litter, where Drogon and his brothers lay basking in the sun. Jiqui unfastened one end of the chain and handed it down to her. When she gave a yank, the black dragon raised its head, hissing, and unfolded wings of night and scarlet. Krasny's Monaclus smiled broadly as their shadow fell across him. Danny handed the slaver the end of Drogon's chain. In return, he presented her with a whip. The handle was black dragon bone, elaborately carved and inlaid with gold. 9 long thin leather lashes trailed from it, each one tipped by a gilded claw. The gold pommel was a woman's head, with pointed ivory teeth.
"The harpy's fingers,"
Grasny's named the scourge. Danny turned the whip in her hand. "Such a light thing, to bear such weight." "Is it done, then? Do they belong to me?"
"It is done,"
he agreed, giving the chain a sharp pull to bring Drogon down from the litter. Danny mounted her silver. She could feel her heart thumping in her chest. She felt desperately afraid. Was this what my brother would have done? She wondered if Prince Rhaegar had been this anxious when he saw the usurper's host formed up across the Trident with all their banners floating in the wind. She stood in her stirrups and raised the harpy's fingers above her head for all the unsullied to see. "It is done," she cried at the top of her lungs. "You are mine." She gave the mare her heels and galloped along the first rank, holding the fingers high. "You are the dragons now. You're bought and paid for. It is done. It is done." She glimpsed old Grasdan, turned his grey head sharply. "He hears me speak Valyrian." The other slavers were not listening. They crowded around Krasny's and the dragon, shouting advice. Though the Astapori yanked and tugged, Drogon would not budge off the litter. Smoke rose grey from his open jaws, and his long neck curled and straightened as he snapped at the slaver's face. "It is time to cross the Trident," Danny thought, as she wheeled and rode her silver back. Her blood riders moved in close around her. "You are in difficulty," she observed.
"He will not come," Krasny said.
"There is a reason. A dragon is no slave." And Danny swept the lash down as hard as she could across the slaver's face. Krasny screamed and staggered back, the blood running red down his cheek into his perfumed beard. The harpy's fingers had torn his features half to pieces with one slash, but she did not pause to contemplate the ruin. "Drogon!" she sang out loudly, sweetly, all her fear forgotten. "Dracarys!" The black dragon spread his wings and roared. A lance of swirling dark flame took Krasny's full in the face. His eyes melted and ran down his cheeks, and the oil in his hair and beard burst so fiercely into fire that for an instant the slaver wore a burning crown twice as tall as his head. The sudden stench of charred meat overwhelmed even his perfume, and his wail seemed to drown all other sound. Then the plaza of punishment blew apart into blood and chaos. The good masters were shrieking, stumbling, shoving one another aside, and tripping over the fringes of their tow-cars in their haste. Drogon flew almost lazily at Krasny's, black wings beating. As he gave the slaver another taste of fire, Iri and Jiqui unchained Viserion and Rhaegal, and suddenly there were three dragons in the air. When Dany turned to look, a third of Astapor's proud, demon-horned warriors were fighting to stay atop their terrified mounts, and another third were fleeing in a bright blaze of shiny copper. One man kept his saddle long enough to draw a sword, but Jogo's whip coiled around his neck and cut off his shout. Another lost a hand to Ricaro's Arak and rode off reeling and spurting blood. Aego sat calmly notching arrows to his bowstring and sending them at Tokars. Silver, gold, or plain, he cared nothing for the fringe. Strong Belwas had his Arak out as well, and he spun it as he charged.
"Spears!"
Dany heard one Astapori shout. It was Grasdan, old Grasdan, in his Tokar heavy with pearls.
"On solid! Defend us! Stop them! Defend your masters! Spears! Swords!"
When Ricaro put an arrow through his mouth, the slaves holding a sedan chair broke and ran, dumping him unceremoniously on the ground. The old man crawled to the first rank of eunuchs, his blood pooling on the bricks. The unsolid did not so much as look down to watch him die. Rank on rank on rank, they stood and did not move. The guards have heard my prayer. "Unsullied!" Dany galloped before them, her silver-gold braid flying behind her, her bell chiming with every stride. "Slay the good masters! Slay the soldiers! Slay every man who wears a tokar or holds a whip, but harm no child under 12, and strike the chains off every slave you see!" She raised the harpy's fingers in the air, and then she flung the scourge aside. "Freedom!" she sang out. "Dracarys! Dracarys! Dracarys!" they shouted back, the sweetest word she'd ever heard. "Dracarys! Dracarys!" And all around them, slavers ran and sobbed and begged and died, and the dusty air was filled with spears and fire.
Eddard. "It's the Hans Tourney that's the cause of all the trouble, my lords," the commander of the City Watch complained to the King's Council.
"The King's Tourney," Ned corrected him, wincing. "I assure you the Hand wants no part of it."
"Well, call it what you will, my lord. The knights have been arriving from all over the realm, and for every knight we get 2 free riders, 3 craftsmen, 6 men-at-arms, 12 merchants, 24 hoers, and more thieves than I dare guess. This cursed heat has half the city in a fever to start, and now with all these visitors, last night we had a drowning, a tavern riot, 3 knife fights, a rape, 2 fires, robberies beyond count, and a drunken horse race down the street of the sisters. The night before, a woman's head was found in the great sept, floating in the rainbow pool. No one seems to know how it got there or who it belongs to."
"How dreadful," Varys said with a shudder. Lord Renly Baratheon was less sympathetic. "If you cannot keep the king's peace, Janus, perhaps a city watch should be commanded by someone who can." Stout Jarly Janus Slint pulled himself up like an angry frog, his bald pate reddening. "Aegon, the dragon himself, could not keep the peace, Lord Renly. I need more men."
"How many?" Ned asked, leaning forward. As ever, Robert had not troubled himself to attend the council session, so it fell to his Hand to speak for him.
"As many as can be gotten, Lord Hand."
"Hire 50 new men," Ned told him. "Lord Baelish, we'll see that you will get the coin."
"I will," Littlefinger said.
"You will. You found 40,000 golden dragons for a champion's purse. Surely you can scrape together a few coppers to keep the king's peace." Ned turned back to Janus Slint. "I will also give you
20 good swords for my own household guard, to serve with a watch until the crowds have left.
All thanks, Lord Hand, Slint said, bowing. I promise you, they shall be put to good use.
When the commander had taken his leave, Eddard Stark turned to the rest of the council. The sooner this folly is done with, the better I shall like it. As if the expense and trouble were not irksome enough, all and sundry insisted on salting Ned's wound by calling it the hand's tourney, as if he were the cause of it. And Robert honestly seemed to think he should feel honoured. The realm prospers from such events, my lord, Grand Maester Pycelle said. They bring the great the chance of glory, and the lowly a respite from their woes.
And put coins in many a pocket, Littlefinger added. Every inn in the city is full, and the whores are walking bow-legged and jingling with each step.
Lord Renly laughed. We're fortunate my brother Stannis is not with us. Remember the time he proposed to outlaw brothels? The king asked him if perhaps he'd like to outlaw eating, shitting, and breathing while he was at it. If truth be told, I oft-times wonder how Stannis ever got that ugly daughter of his. He goes to his marriage bed like a man marching to a battlefield with a grim look in his eyes and a determination to do his duty.
Ned had not joined the laughter. I wonder about your brother Stannis as well. I wonder whether he intends to end his visit to Dragonstone and resume his seat on this council.
No doubt as soon as we have scourged all those whores into the sea, Littlefinger replied, provoking more laughter.
I've heard quite enough about whores for one day, Ned said, rising. Until the morrow.
Harwin had the door when Ned returned to the Tower of the Hand. Summon Jory to my chambers.
And tell your father to saddle my horse, Ned told him too briskly. As you say, my lord.
The Red Keep and the Hand's tourney were chafing him raw, Ned reflected as he climbed. He yearned for the comfort of Catelyn's arms, for the sounds of Rob and John crossing swords in the practice yard, for the cool days and cold nights of the north. In his chambers he stripped off his council silks and sat for a moment with a book, while he waited for Jory to arrive. The lineages and histories of the great houses of the Seven Kingdoms, with descriptions of many high lords and noble ladies and their children, by Grand Maester Melian. Pycelle had spoken truly. It made for ponderous reading. Yet John Arryn had asked for it, and Ned felt certain he had reasons. There was something here, some truth buried in these brittle yellow pages, if only he could see it. But what? The tome was over a century old. Scarcely a man now alive had yet been born when Melian had compiled his dusty lists of weddings, births, and deaths. He opened to the section of House Lannister once more and turned the pages slowly, hoping against hope that something would leap out at him. The Lannisters were an old family, tracing their descent back to Lan the Clever, a trickster from the Age of Heroes, who was no doubt as legendary as Bran the Builder, though far more beloved of singers and tale-tellers. In the songs, Lan was a fellow who winkled the Castleys out of Castle Rock with no weapon but his wits, and stole gold from the sun to brighten his curly hair. Ned wished he were here now to winkle the truth out of this damnable book. A sharp rap on the door heralded Jory Cassell. Ned closed Malian's tome and bid him enter. "I have promised the city watch 20 of my guard until the tourney is done," he told him. "I rely on you to make the choice. Give Alan the command, and make certain the men understand that they are needed to stop fights, not start them." Rising, Ned opened a cedar chest and removed a light linen undertunic. "Did you find the stable boy?"
"The watchman, my lord," Jory said. "He vows he'll never touch another horse."
"What do you have to say?"
"He claims he knew Lord Arryn well. Fast friends they were," Jory snorted. "The Hand always gave the lads a cupper on their name days," he says. "Had a way with horses. Never rode his mounts too hard and brought them carrots and apples, so they was always pleased to see him.
Carrots and apples, Ned repeated. It sounds as if this boy would be even less use than the others. And he was the last of the four Littlefinger had turned up. Jory had spoken to each of them in turn. Sir Hugh had been brusque and uninformative and arrogant, as only a new-made knight can be. If the hand wished to talk to him, he should be pleased to receive him. But he would not be questioned by a mere captain of guards, even if said captain was 10 years older and 100 times a swordsman. The serving girl had at least been pleasant. She said Lord John had been reading more than was good for him, that he was troubled and melancholy over his young son's frailty, and gruff with his lady wife. The potboy, Noel Cordwainer, had never exchanged so much as a word with Lord John, but he was full of oddments of kitchen gossip. The Lord had been quarrelling with the king. The Lord only picked at his food. The Lord was sending his boy to be fostered on Dragonstone. The Lord had taken a great interest in the breeding of hunting hounds. The Lord had visited a master armourer to commission a new suit of plate, wrought all in plain silver, with a blue jasper falcon and a mother-of-pearl moon on the breast. The king's own brother had gone with him to help choose the design, the potboy said. No, not Lord Renly, the other one, Lord Stannis. Did our watchman recall anything else of note? The lad swears Lord John was as strong as a man half his age. Often went riding with Lord Stannis, he says. Stannis again, Ned thought. He found that curious. John Arryn and he had been cordial, but never friendly. And while Robert had been riding north to Winterfell, Stannis had removed himself to Dragonstone, the Targaryen island fastness he had conquered in his brother's name. He had given no word as to when he might return. "Where did they go on these rides?" Ned asked. "A boy said they visited a brothel." "A brothel?" Ned said. "The Lord of the Eyrie and Hand of the King visited a brothel with Stannis Baratheon?" He shook his head, incredulous, wondering what Lord Renly would make of this titbit. Robert's lusts were the subject of ribald drinking songs throughout the realm, but Stannis was a different sort of man, a bare year younger than the king, yet utterly unlike him, stern, humourless, unforgiving, grim in his sense of duty. "The boy insists it's true. The hand took 3 guardsmen with him, and the boy says they were joking of it when he took their horses afterwards." "Which brothel?" Ned asked. "The boy did not know. The guards would." "A pity Lysa carried them off to the Vale," Ned said dryly. "The guards are doing their best to vex us. Lady Lysa, Maester Coleman, Lord Stannis, everyone who might actually know the truth of what happened to John Arryn is 1,000 leagues away. Will you summon Lord Stannis back from Dragonstone?" "Not yet," Ned said. "Not until I have a better notion of what this is all about and where he stands." The matter nagged at him. Why did Stannis leave? Had he played some part in John Arryn's murder? Or was he afraid? Ned found it hard to imagine what could frighten Stannis Baratheon, who had once held Storm's End through a year of siege, surviving on rats and boot leather, while the Lords Tyrell and Redwine sat outside with their hosts banqueting in sight of his walls. "Bring me my doublet, if you would, the grey with the direwolf sigil. I want this armour to know who I am. It might make him more forthcoming." Jory went to the wardrobe. "Lord Renly is brother to Lord Stannis, as well as the king." "Yes, it seems that he was not invited on these rides." Ned was not sure what to make of Renly, with all his friendly ways and easy smiles. A few days past, he had taken Ned aside to show him an exquisite rose-gold locket. Inside was a miniature, painted in the vivid Mearish style, of a lovely young girl with doe eyes and a cascade of soft brown hair. Renly had seemed anxious to know if the girl reminded him of anyone, and when Ned had no answer but a shrug, he seemed disappointed. The maid was Loras Tyrell's sister Margaery, he'd confessed. But there were those who said she looked like Lyanna. No, Ned had told him, bemused. Could it be that Lord Renly, who looked so like a young Robert, had conceived a passion for a girl he fancied to be young Lyanna? That struck him as more than passing queer. Jorry held out the doublet, and Ned slid his hands through the armholes. Perhaps Lord Stannis will return for Robert's tourney, he said as Jorry laced the garment up the back. That would be a stroke of fortune, my lord, Jorry said. Ned buckled on his longsword. In other words, not bloody likely. His smile was grim. Jorry draped Ned's cloak across his shoulders and clasped it at the throat with a hand's badge of office. The armourer lives above his shop, in a large house at the top of the Street of Steel. Alan knows the way, my lord. Ned nodded. The gods help this putboy if he sent me off herring after shadows. It was a slim enough staff to lean on. The John Aaron that Ned Stark had known was not one to wear jewelled and silvered plate. Steel was steel. It was meant for protection, not ornament. He might have changed his views, to be sure. He would scarcely have been the first man who came to look on things differently after a few years at court. But the change was marked enough to make Ned wonder. Is there any other service I might perform? I suppose you'd best begin visiting whorehouses. Hard duty, my lord, Jorry grinned. The men will be glad to help. Porter has made a fair start already. Ned's favourite horse was saddled and waiting in the yard. Varley and Jax fell in beside him as he rode through the yard. Their steel caps and shirts of mail must have been sweltering, yet they said no word of complaint. As Lord Eddard passed beneath the King's Gate into the stink of the city, his grey and white cloak streaming from his shoulders, he saw eyes everywhere and kicked his mount into a trot. His guard followed. He looked behind him frequently as they made their way through the crowded streets. Tamard and Desmond had left the castle early this morning to take up positions on the route they must take and watch for anyone following them. But even so, Ned was uncertain. The shadow of the king's spider and his little birds had him fretting like a maiden on a wedding night. The Street of Steel began at the market square beside the River Gate, as it was named on maps, or the Mud Gate, as it was commonly called. A mummer on stilts was striding through the throngs like some great insect, with a horde of barefoot children trailing behind him, hooting. Elsewhere, two ragged boys, no older than Bran, were dueling with sticks, to the loud encouragement of some and the furious curses of others. An old woman ended the contest by leaning out of her window and emptying a bucket of slops on the heads of the combatants. In the shadow of the wall, farmers stood beside their wagons, bellowing out, "Apples, the best apples, cheap at twice the price, and blood melons, sweet as honey, and turnips, onions, roots. Here you go, here you go, turnips, onions, roots, here you go, here." The mud gate was opened, and a squad of city watchmen stood under the portcullis, in their golden cloaks leaning on spears. When a column of riders appeared from the west, the guardsmen sprang into action, shouting commands and moving the carts and foot traffic aside to let the knight enter with his escort. The first rider, through the gate, carried a long black banner. The silk rippled in the wind like a living thing. Across the fabric was blazoned a night sky slashed with purple lightning. "Make way for Lord Beric," the rider shouted. "Make way for Lord Beric." And close behind came the young lord himself, a dashing figure on a black courser, with red gold hair and a black satin cloak dusted with stars. "Here to fight in the hands tourney, my lord?" a guardsman called out to him. "Here to win the hands tourney," Lord Beric shouted back as the crowd cheered. Ned turned off the square where the Street of Steel began and followed its winding path up a long hill past blacksmiths working at open forges, free riders haggling over mail shirts, and grizzled ironmongers selling old blades and razors from their wagons. The farther they climbed, the larger the buildings grew. The man they wanted was all the way at the top of the hill, in a huge house of timber and plaster, whose upper stories loomed over the narrow street. The double doors showed a hunting scene carved in ebony and weirwood. A pair of stone knights stood sentry at the entrance, armoured in fanciful suits of polished red steel that transformed them